Okay, that may or may not work, but we'll begin. There have been a number of addresses here in recent months looking at some of the challenges about how we interpret violent texts in the Bible. I remember Paul gave a very good one, I found very helpful anyway, a few months ago, where he summarised a lot of the key issues surrounding this kind of thing. How do I minimise or blank that?
B?
Yep, great. Thanks. And how do I get it back? I press B again? Okay. So Paul summarised some of the issues, and I think he summarised a very key question towards the end when he said it may come down to a decision about whether the Bible is a book written by God about people or a book written by people about God. I think that's a very important thing to reflect on. Underlying our questions about the way we analyse texts is often our fundamental discomfort about a God who apparently orders the wholesale slaughter of men, women and children. As Richard Dawkins has quipped, this is surely one of the most distasteful fictional characters in all of literature. And we might want to share some of that view. And then a couple of weeks ago, Tony wrestled with a particularly difficult passage in Joshua chapter 7 about the stoning and burning of Achan, his whole family and all his worldly goods. So I've been asked today to take this reflection a little bit further by giving an overview of the work of a theologian named James Allison, who visited Perth towards the end of last year. James Allison is a Catholic theologian born in England, but who spent a fair amount of time living in South America. He's written what I think is some of the most interesting new insights into biblical interpretation in recent years. James Allison, I think, gives us some very interesting interpretive keys that we can use for reading biblical texts. But of course, whether those keys work will depend on whether or not you accept the underpinning theory that he suggests. And he offers some of the interpretive keys that he offers are based on the work of a historian and anthropologist by the name of René Girard. René Girard wrote a very significant piece in 1978 called Things Hidden from the Foundation of the World. Things Hidden from the Foundation of the World, in which René Girard, as an anthropologist and historian, provides a theory of violence and human culture. The basic question is, what are the roots of human violence in society? And if we understood what some of the roots of human violence were, what would that tell us about the way we read the Bible? So what I wanted to do first is to give a very quick introduction to René Girard's theory of scapegoating violence, and then say, well, if we were to take that theory and apply it to our interpretation of the Bible, as James Allison does, then what would we end up with? What insights might that give us? So here's a René Girard in a nutshell. So basically what René Girard suggests is that we have a fundamental scarcity of stuff. In other words, food, for example, or land, or if we don't have a scarcity, maybe we have a perception of a scarcity. So that's where it starts. And if we have scarcity, then potentially we have competition. And one of the most important significant things about René Girard's theory is that human beings are basically imitative creatures. Our desire is formed by the desire of others. Now, this is a key idea in everything that I'm going to say today. So this is one idea to anchor in the forefront of our mind, that we are imitative beings and that our desire is shaped by the desire of others. That's his anthropological principle, if you like, which underpins everything else. So if we don't accept that, everything else falls. The human beings are imitative. So, for example, if we've got two little children in the house, or two toddlers, or two friends who come to play, we all know that if one child has the toy, the other child wants it. Yes? We know. So it has a kind of a face validity about it. The same is true for us as adults. And this is the way the Christmas sales work. if you can generate enough desire in people's consciousness that everybody thinks that everybody else wants something, you'll generate a very heightened level of desire in a group of people. So you get the phenomena of hundreds of people lining up outside Myers at 6 o'clock in the morning to rush in. Why? Because I might miss out. There's scarcity and competition. And sometimes that can lead to violence at the stands.
And iPads,
yeah. So just think about any situation where it's the way advertisers work. They try to generate desire by imitating desire. So they put two very attractive, gorgeous people on the screen desiring a particular product, and we, by imitation, want to desire that product as well. So potentially this leads to violence, potentially escalating and unrestrained. So communities and societies need a way of actually restoring order. So the way, according to René Girard's theory, the way this happens is that unconsciously the community of people search around looking for a scapegoat. Now largely this happens at an unconscious level. They say, we've got this violent situation here. What was the source of the violence? How did this happen? What were the underpinnings? What gave rise to this violence in the first place? So the society, the community of people starts ranging around looking for somebody to blame for the violent situation that's occurring. Usually it's somebody who looks a bit different or has some distinguishing feature which sets them apart from the group. And the group then, almost as one, unanimously blames that particular person. Says, it's your fault. And the group almost instantaneously does this in some mysterious way. That person's to blame. So the guilt of a sacrificial victim is identified, and that person is killed. Now, I don't know if anyone saw the documentary about Gandhi a few weeks ago. I don't know if you remember towards the end of the second episode when they talked about the killing of Gandhi, how a hush fell upon the crowd. This is an eyewitness said, the place hushed. And this is what René Girard says, is that when a sacrificial victim is killed, or in fact when anyone is killed, a hush falls across a group of people. It's such a shocking thing to occur. And René Girard suggests that the hush of peace around the killing of a sacrificial victim reinforces the choice of the victim. That the victim is guilty because peace is restored after the killing of the victim. This is an interesting idea. It actually self-reinforces. And so everyone can say, oh, they were guilty, because now we have peace. In other words, the unanimity of the group is purchased at the sake of at the cost of a sacrificial victim. Now that's, if we think about that, is a fairly powerful thought. So René Girard suggests is that communities bind themselves together through their choices of victims. If we can find somebody to blame, and if we can all cohere around that, then our society will be bound together in peace. And he calls that the myth of redemptive violence. The only trouble is that it doesn't work for very long, because we're competitive and we have a perception of scarcity, and therefore before long we're in violence again, and then we have to find another sacrificial victim in order to restore peace. So the way communities deal with this is that they develop rituals of sacrificial violence to substitute for and restrain human violence. So for example, human sacrifices to appease God, sacrificial victims. And eventually, giving way, as it does in the Bible with the story of the near sacrifice of Isaac, rituals in which sins can be confessed and sent away. So communities evolve from sacrificing humans to sacrificing animals. And so we have the scapegoating ritual, which Bevan read at before from Leviticus. Very neat ritual in which the people load all their sins onto the back of a sacrificial animal, send it off into the wilderness, and it's off our backs, it's on the animal, and the animal's gone. So that's basically the gist of René Girard's theory of sacrificial violence. It's not bought entirely in anthropological circles. Some people have criticised it, and they've said, well, you can find societies that don't operate this way, or give real examples. A lot of his work comes from analysing literature, for example, so... But anyway, I think it's an interesting theory to consider. It seems to have a face validity about it anyway, in certain situations. The only trouble is that rituals of sacrifice and forgiveness don't entirely do away with cultural or religious violence, as we saw a couple of weeks ago when Tony was speaking about the story in Joshua 7. Or as we see in the story of Jesus, where the high priest says, "It is expedient, don't you know, that one man die for the sake of the nation?" It's expedient that this man die. If we can kill this guy, everything's going to be okay. We'll restore our social order, because look at him. Look what's happening. Everything's being destabilized. So even though there are rituals in which sins can be confessed and sent away, and apparently the order of a community can be restored, it doesn't work. Why? Because the underpinning violence of what's going on in the community of people is not being addressed. And that is the underpinning assumption that the only way we can restore violence is by killing something. This is what Gerard and James Allison says is the fundamentally underpinning lie. It is the lie of human culture. The only way we can restore violence is by killing someone. Restore peace. We can certainly restore violence by killing. So religiously justified violence keeps breaking out because the underlying lie is never actually addressed. Someone has to pay. So, based on René Girard's work, someone has coined the phrase, well, certainly James Allison has, the myth of redemptive violence as the primary underlying story and lie of all human culture. It could be summarised as, somebody's got to pay. And when we become alert to it, it seems to be that it's the only game in town. So, what's the time? 22. I'm just monitoring the time so I can get us out of here before 11. That's my promise to you. I'm a J on the Myers-Briggs. Right. So talk to the person next to you. Where do you think that you may have witnessed scapegoating violence this week? Where do you think you may have witnessed some kind of scapegoating violence this week? Just a minute to talk to the person next to you. Okay, some examples, quick examples. Gaddafi scapegoating the Western media. I'm not going to say whether... what we're hearing is only coming from the Western media. Yeah. I'm not going to buy into whether these are accurate or not, or what I think of them. Let's just hear them. So any others? Okay, Al Qaeda's fault. Yeah. Anything?
Bradley Manning being scapegoated for a complete lack of security in the US intelligence.
Right.
Claire talked about office politics where it's always
everybody's. In office politics, it's somebody else's fault. Somebody, you know, often, have you seen that in offices? If we can only deal with this person, everything in our office would be hunky dory.
Julian Assange?
Yeah.
Like 7 photocopies.
Oh, blaming one person for stuffing everything up.
Oh,
it's a photocopy as well. Keep the photocopy at a death. Yeah. Inanimate scapegoats. Any others?
Somebody always loses my glasses.
Somebody else's fault, yeah. But your glasses are lost. Yeah, I know that one. It's possible that Gaddafi has been scapegoated for the sins of the nation. Yeah. Oh, that's very undermining of the scapegoating. Yeah. That's a very gospel bumper sticker, actually. So, can I quote? Thank you. That's right. You're jumping one step ahead. Just come back to that. It's a nice segue, actually, into thinking about, well, how does gospel address scapegoating violence? If we were to read gospel through the lens of this theory, what would we find? Well, we find that not only find the myth of redemptive violence within the pages of Scripture, that's the first thing that's interesting to look for, but also, I think, hopefully, counter movements or tensions occurring within the text. So we find hints of suspicion, as if the biblical authors are already trying to extract themselves from the myth of redemptive violence. And this is where it moves into territory of theology and James Allison, who looks at the text and says, where do we find tensions occurring within the text which seem to be manifesting the myth of redemptive violence, the foundational myth and lie of human culture within the text, and where do the authors seem to be trying to extract themselves from it? And he said it's not as simple as looking, this is the heresy that's often launched, that it's all the Old Testament is about the myth of redemptive violence and the New is about the undercutting of that. It's the Old Testament's fault. Yeah, that's right. But that this strand actually runs right through the text from beginning to end, that these tensions occur where the community is trying to extract itself from the myth of redemptive violence. So, for example, just a couple of simple examples. In the Isaac story, the movement is from a God who expects human sacrifice to a God who is satisfied with animal sacrifice. That's step one. The tribal God of Israel gradually giving way to the creator God of all nations, tribes, languages and people. A God who apparently demands sacrifice in the priestly tradition, in tension with a God who does not require animal sacrifice in the prophets. Go and learn this, what this requires. I do not require sacrifice but mercy. I don't need the blood of animals. I don't eat animals. So you get these tensions occurring right through the Old Testament. And then finally to Jesus, who becomes the entirely innocent victim of human sacrifice rather than the perpetrator or promoter of blood sacrifice. So Jesus, quoting earlier prophets, makes the statement, go and learn what this requires. I don't require mercy. I don't require sacrifice, I require mercy. Rather than God needing or demanding sacrifice, God sacrifices God's self in order to end all sacrificial religion. I'll just repeat that. Rather than God requiring violence or sacrifice, God sacrifices God's self in order to end all sacrificial religion. Now, if that's true, that changes everything in the world. But that is pure gospel. According to Rene Girard and those like James Allison who would be willing to take this line, the sacrifice of Christ literally is a world-changing and culture-changing event. So three simple examples of that. Jesus is declared innocent by the church, by the first disciples. So if we can kill Christ, how wrong can we get it? We, not them, not those people back then who made that mistake, but if we can kill the Christ, how wrong can we get it? This is a very sobering thing to think about. And so James Allison says, the virus of the gospel is planted within culture. A new and world-changing sensitivity to victims everywhere. And here's the fantastic trap. Can we play the game of who the biggest victim is? Oh, I'm a bigger victim than you are. It's your fault that my victimhood isn't being sorted out. Secondly, Jesus declares the forgiveness of enemies. Now this, someone said to me the other day, I thought was a very useful statement. The radicalness of Christianity is not that Jesus says, love your neighbour. The radicalness of Christianity is that Jesus says, love your enemies. So Jesus says God's rain and sunshine falls equally on the good and the evil. And our desire to follow the law and to be good can be an excellent way of being clear about who is bad and therefore worthy of exclusion and killing. Just have a read of Psalm number 1. Psalm number 1 I don't think necessarily has to lead down this path, but it can certainly be read in that way to support the myth of redemptive violence. But what the gospel says is this, that the judgment of God is God loves sinners. While we were still sinners, Christ died for us. So to imitate Christ is to love our enemies, which breaks the power of tribal scapegoating, and it destabilizes culture. Because if we don't have permission to kill our enemies, how are we possibly going to stabilize our community? Like if we can't find the right people to lock up, kill, how are we going to stabilize our community? It's a very, very scary culture to live in which our enemies have not been clearly identified. And so this gives why René Girard said that the eschatological imagination, in other words, the end of history informed by the resurrection of Christ and the command to love our enemies, subverts the apocalyptic imagination. The apocalyptic imagination is the imagination where in the end God will slaughter all God's enemies. And so he says this is an example even within the New Testament of these two strands, the myth of redemptive violence and the gospel continuing to sit in tension with each other. That the gospel is constantly at risk of being undercut by the apocalyptic imagination. Of course, it's just one way of thinking about it. Could be completely wrong. But is there any justice in the world? This is the question. Somebody's got to pay. Surely, it just makes sense that somebody's got to pay. So, James Allison points out how difficult it is to hear the gospel. It's so radical that even within the period of writing of the New Testament, even within the period of 40 to 60 years, the strands of apocalyptic violence are creeping back into the texts. And so by the time we reach the book of Revelation, which incidentally was not included in the canon for about 400 years, because there was so much controversy about whether or not to include it, but it's probably very important that it is there, because it holds up a mirror to us about how easy it is for apocalyptic violence to creep back into our thinking. So by the time we reach the book of Revelation, we no longer have a risen Jesus forgiving his enemies, but a reversion to God the Slayer. So, I'll just finish with a quote, and then if there's any questions, we might be able to take a couple. And if anyone wants to fight me or argue with, not me, James Allison.
Someone's got to
pay. Go to the next slide. So Richard Rohr has this observation, which I thought was a lovely quote. Jesus took away the sin of the world, by exposing it, first of all, as different than we imagined, and letting us know that our pattern of ignorant killing, attacking and blaming, is in fact history's primary illusion or primary lie. Then Jesus shared with us a great participatory love, which would make it possible for us to not hate at all. The game was over with Jesus, at least for those who gazed long enough. There's a lovely passage in 2 Corinthians where Paul says that as we gaze at the Lord, we are transformed from one degree of glory to another. Have you ever thought that if we're made in the image of a Christ-like God who commands us to love our enemies, what happens when we look at that Jesus long enough? And so, just as a final, it's what James Allison says, the Christian hope consists precisely in our daring to ask with insistence that the forgiving victim becomes present to us, inviting us to his banquet as one who burrows a hole in our hut, arriving like a thief in the night, so that we don't miss through sleep the wretching invitation to build the celestial counterstory in the teeth of death. That we are, when we proclaim the gospel, are being invited to proclaim a celestial counterstory to the culture of death. That's all from me. Questions, thoughts, heart attacks? Yes, he would say the judgment of God is this, that Christ died for sinners. That's the bottom line for James Allison.
Protection?
Sorry?
So, the apocalyptic doesn't have to be God the slayer, which is bloodthirsty, but God the defender or the protector?
Yep.
James
Allison talks a lot about ultimately that God is God of life. What would it mean to live as if death were not? The trap or the temptation is to be constantly being called into the culture of death. And how do we reshape our imaginations differently? So if you're asking, is underlying your, I'm not sure if underlying your question is where is justice?
No.
No? Okay, well, I'm not...
We live in a world where everyone isn't Christian, everyone isn't peaceful, and would do harm.
Yeah.
And that realisation that we need to protect innocent from that. To protect is not about justice, it's protection.
Oh, yeah.
It doesn't seem to be anywhere in the scheme of mission so far.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I think what he would do is, he doesn't talk about a lot of that in detail, but I'm sure he would say that's a very good thing for a society to do, is to protect the weak, absolutely, and to be willing to die for it, actually. And to be, so that hugely, they're very important. But to tease out the unconscious mechanism of scapegoating from the real issue of seeing truth clearly. So being able to name truth, but always being aware that what are my potentially unconscious projections that are going on here. So he would say it's teasing those out is really important. Otherwise, we will accidentally and unconsciously fall into scapegoating. Yeah, thanks. That's really important. Yeah.
I just want to check that I've got something right here. So you're saying that you're hoping, or James Allison, are hoping that in fact it was not God's deliberate intention to promote scapegoatism as the method of choice, but that in fact it was just a reflection of what happened. Jesus just happened to come into a world where scapegoating was the way that society dealt with these days.
Yeah, I'd say James Allison would probably say, I think, that that God redeems the scapegoating mechanism through the cross.
I can't do that.
In other words, God doesn't kill Jesus. In other words, he completely would take out the myth, he would say that the penal substitution theory of the atonement, for example, is culture interpreting the cross in a way which is through the myth of redemptive
violence. Yeah. The next thing is that, in fact, the church has actually been deliberately maintaining and perpetuating the myth of scapegoatism as the preferred mechanism for sorting out problems.
Absolutely. Yep.
So
he says
that's awful.
Yeah. So
we've been promoting
Well, he's just constantly calling us to be aware of where we do that, and that the church can do that as well as anyone. That's because we're human. So the first challenge is to the church before we go anywhere else.
I'm wondering how come that this book, Bible, is so popular for so long time. I think the contradictions that are in the book makes it interesting, and the most important message is keep thinking.
Yeah. I agree. This is just one approach to reading the Bible. Sorry.
My understanding is that God didn't require Jesus to kill, but he allowed people to do what they wanted to in order to take it to its ultimate and then defeat it.
Yep.
So it was a case of saying, this is what you, if this is how you want to deal with it, I'll let you, but I'll effectively take it away from you by conquering it.
Yep. Yeah, that's certainly one well-established view of what's happening in the death of Jesus, which I subscribe to personally. James Allison would say, if you read one of his books, you would hear him articulate that in 300 pages of beautiful language, saying that what is possible, and you've done it beautifully and succinctly, but what is possible is what's shaped by the eschatological imagination, meaning that which is shaped by the resurrection of Christ. What does it mean to live as if death were not? Sorry, it's the last one, Claire, because it's past 11 and I'm a jade.
Me too. I was just the phrase we use for me around that is when any issue rises in me, the tendency of who's the problem and what's wrong is having been invited several years ago to think on any issue, not what am I against but what am I for. The key issue that I was initially brought up to was about the abortion debate, not if I am against abortion. What am I for? I'm pro-teenage mothers, I'm pro-supporting single women, and that notion of, on any issue, what am I for is the more important question out of an issue has been why I think I've been addressing this kind of stuff.
Thank you. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, Mike.
You're welcome.
Pressure resistance.